There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Sunday, March the 8th, International Women's Day.
Well, we're focusing on our top story this morning, the oil price, which fell off a cliff, I'm afraid, in Friday's session, down more than 10%, worst day in more than a decade since the depths of the financial crisis. It's all to do with Saudi Arabia and Russia. For the past 3 years, they have been collaborating in a group known as OPEC Plus, or OPEC and Friends, to cut supply, reducing supply, thereby propping up the price. And it's worked, more or less, for 3 years or so. And everyone expected at the big OPEC meeting in Vienna last week that they would roll over the existing cuts and maybe throw in a few more. However, that did not happen. Here's Ethna Trainer. She's a Dubai-based energy expert. She was there in Vienna last week, very close to many people within OPEC. And Thursday night, everything seemed absolutely fine. You went to bed, Brandy.
Thursday night, I thought it was a done deal.
So did everybody. By Friday night, though, not only was there no deal, but that three-year collaboration between Russia and Saudi Arabia appeared to be unravelling altogether. Ethna picks up the story.
Come Thursday, all of the OPEC ministers meet. Everybody seems optimistic that a deal can be done and that the Russians will be won over. So come Friday morning, Mr. Novak, the Russian energy minister, comes back into town for the scheduled 10 o'clock OPEC Plus meeting, the meeting of OPEC and friends, so to speak. He goes into a private consultation with the prince, and that goes on for hours. So by now, the media and the analyst community, they're getting very nervous. And while they're expecting the worst scenario, they really did not believe it would happen. They considered maybe a lower number, a different time frame, but everybody expected an actual decision. It was after 6 o'clock in the evening when the meeting broke off with no agreement in place. And the two key ministers, Russia and Saudi Arabia, departed swiftly without any public comment. So what happens now? Well, it's really anybody's guess. Bob McNally, the founder of the Rapidem Group, says that the oil price can now go into negative free fall until the ministers agree to production cuts.
We've had our own oil expert in the studio this morning, Ed Bell, Senior Director of Market Economics from Emirates NBD. We asked him what happened.
We had a very somewhat aggressive proposal from the core OPEC countries on Thursday last week, saying that they were going to cut production by 1.5 million barrels a day. And I think the market was looking at that relatively positively, as though that was the deal that had been reached. But as the news trickled out, that was very much revealed to be the proposal. So it's sort of what OPEC's wish list was. And when the plus parts of OPEC Plus, so Russia, Kazakhstan, a lot of these other countries joined in for the session on the Thursday or the Friday, they're very much opposed to taking on this additional share of production cut. So we saw that the Russians in particular still think it's too early to really assess the impact that COVID-19, that the coronavirus has had on oil consumption. And so they're very hesitant to make any adjustments to production at this point. So with no deal agreed at the end of the week, it does look like the OPEC Plus arrangement that's been in place for the last couple of years is headed for a kind of disorderly breakup. The Russian energy minister, Alexander Novak, effectively saying that as of April 1st, OPEC Plus countries are free to produce whatever kind of level they want. And if we had a subsequent increase in production, we could really see oil prices heading into a tailspin. Already, as you saw, a big sell-off in Friday in response to this news.
And so the million dirham question, of course, is what does it mean for us?
Yeah, so there's two feedbacks for the region. One is in the form of lower oil prices. So we have Brent prices below $50, and it looks like we might be now centering in a range of $40 to $50 a barrel. So far below any of the fiscal break-even points for any of the Gulf economies. On the flip side, if there is a push to increase production as countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, try to carve up more of the market share, then you might get a boost in terms of real GDP growth as a result of that. The oil sector has been a bit of a drag on growth in the last few years as a result of the OPEC production cuts. But if we see actually an increase, remember Saudi Arabia is producing roughly about 1 million barrels a day below its peak level. So that's an enormous amount of capacity that could come back into the market. The corollary, though, is the impact on pricing could be very, very bad.
So It's all quite gloomy. Very, very bad. Free fall. Not comments we want to hear in association with the oil price. Do you want a whiff of optimism, Brandy?
I do.
Well, it's going to come not from me, but from Mohamed Barkindo. He is the Secretary General of OPEC, has been for 4 or 5 years now, so this is not his first rodeo. And after all of this unraveled, there was no press conference from Saudi or from Russia, but he went to face the media. And you can see him, and it's lots of our mates from here in Dubai. There's people like Manus Cranny from Bloomberg on one hand and John Defterios from CNN on the other, all asking him similar questions. And he did come out at the end and say this.
I am a born optimist. I believe that nobody in this group of countries would like us to relapse into the last downturn that we went through 2014, 2015, 2016. They are all conscious of that.
Let's hope he is proved right. That's Mohamed Barkindo of OPEC.
Right. Having a look at how the coronavirus is affecting business around the world. Number of headlines, obviously, things changing on a day-to-day basis. Starbucks, by the way, has temporarily in the States stopped filling reusable cups. So if you've got your keep cup or the rest of it, you're doing your right thing by using a reusable cup. For the moment, they're not going to be filling them. And I can understand why, because you don't necessarily know how well people have washed them at home and all the rest of it. So I get there. By the way, when I was in Mexico, they weren't just selling reusable cups, but they had an alternative to plastic straws that was the cookie straw.
So you're having one of those incredibly sugary kind of frappuccino type things.
Yeah, because you use them for the cold drinks, don't you?
Yeah, and just in case there's not enough sugar in that, they make you a straw made out of sugar.
Yeah, green and white stripe, very cheery indeed.
Happy days.
Let's look at a survey that's come out from Fast Company. They've been surveying business executives in the US about what's changed and what hasn't. The good news is that only a third of executives reckon that the coronavirus is going to impact them enough to make them revise their earnings estimates that they've put out for 2020, which is very interesting. And that is very different than I would have expected, if I'm being quite blunt, because the rest of the things that they've said in this survey is all about things they're having to put in place. 65% of executives saying that customers are changing the way they spend. 40% reworking supply chains. Obviously, a lot of bottlenecks have come out, becoming more diverse. 66% of executives say that they have cancelled business travel or changed their business travel plans.
It does seem a very optimistic assessment that two-thirds think that their bottom line and their top line won't massively be effective. I, of course, hope that they are proved right. But travel plans is the big one, isn't it? I was looking at, I'm sure you were as well, various surveys and reports over the weekend. And the two areas that the United States is looking at very, very closely is travel and the supply chain. There are others, but those are the two big ones. And by travel, we include the entertainment industry as well. And a lot of people are changing their travel plans.
Well, look, you're joining the staycation army.
Yeah.
Because you were, well, you were initially heading off to Italy, weren't you? That's not happening anymore.
I was going to go to Italy end of April. Yeah, big design fair there. That's not happening. Hadn't booked that, though. I'd booked my time off, but hadn't booked my flights. That one's canned. Many be going to Sri Lanka about 10 days' time. England's playing cricket there. Load of guys from Dubai were heading out there. That's off.
Have you decided as a group that you're not going?
No.
Or is it just you not going?
There's a WhatsApp group and some are going, some are not going.
Because you have to make a decision, don't you? And you're not making that decision just for you. Quite frankly, Richard Dean, you're also making it for us.
Exactly, yeah. Because if I go away and come back, and I may leave and Sri Lanka is absolutely fine, but by the time I come back 3 days later, it's on a list, then I've got to quarantine myself for 14 days. And that's probably not fair on my family, and it's probably not fair on
me,
on my work colleagues as well. So you've got to think about these things. I'd booked a week's holiday skiing with the family. We're going to go to Georgia, jumping on that bandwagon. That one's off as well. I've cancelled the Airbnb, got to cancel the flights.
How easy has it been to cancel stuff? There's a question.
It's just beginning now. Airbnb was great. Cancelled it. Even the person who owns the Airbnb in Georgia wrote back saying, you know what, schools are shut here as well. I think you're doing the right thing. Haven't tried the flights yet. It's Georgia, so it's Fly Dubai. I'm guessing that's going to be okay. We're hearing that Emirates and Etihad are having some kind of waivers. I mean, you never quite know the small print. But my flight to Sri Lanka, I booked through a travel agent.
And that's been the stumbling block.
Which is a rookie. It's through an Air Miles program of my bank. So I had no choice but to book it through a travel agent. It's always a nightmare. Not all travel agents are a nightmare, but always this one is particularly a nightmare and difficult to change. So we'll see. I've paid in front for my hotel in Sri Lanka. To be honest, wasn't particularly expensive.
But this is where, I mean, there's a short term, obviously, companies are scrambling to figure out what to do in a lot of cases. Long term, though, if you want Richard Dean to be booking with you in 2021, 2022, 2023, it's how you handle things now that will determine post-virus whether you get people's business back or not.
Long-term relationships always, always count.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
It is International Women's Day. We're joined in the studio today by a string of successful female business leaders, including Amanda Lyne, who is a partner with PwC, the large professional services firm, in particular the PwC Academy. Amanda, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Good morning, Richard. Good morning, Brandy.
I'm going to start with our Twitter poll this morning, which is asking the very simple question. On International Women's Day, we're asking, has the glass ceiling in the UAE been shattered, or is it still firmly in place? Which way would you vote, Amanda?
I would say it's well and truly cracked. Whether it's totally shattered yet, I'm not sure. But significant progress, I think, is towards a fully shattered glass ceiling is being made in the UAE.
Well, it's interesting. You're kind of bang on. We didn't give people the third option, but 54% of people saying shattered and 45% saying in place. So it opinions are divided on this one. Well, let's look at, I'm going to say glass half full, half empty. That's too many glass metaphors.
Yes.
Let's look at the positive side of things. I know you at PwC have done a lot of research on this, your survey of women in the work. You surveyed 3,000 business leaders across the region.
Yeah.
What did you learn?
We learned that there's been great progress, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years. In the UAE, participation of women in the workforce has increased from 29 to 40%. In Saudi, it's up from 14% to 22%. That seems to be a mixture of both government initiatives. So in the UAE, we have a draft law on equal pay, obviously the statutory maternity leave, etc. In Saudi, you've got initiatives like women driving and, of course, changes in the guardianship rules. All of that is helping women get back into the workplace.
In terms of your own personal story, you've been working in this region for a decade or more now in senior positions, a lot of that time with PwC. Just in terms of attitude that you have faced, have you faced any barriers from doing business, even in Saudi Arabia years and years ago, before the recent changes?
No, it's really interesting because I heard you ask Brandy that question earlier on about, and you said, Brandy, when you leave the country, people say to you, what's it like working as a woman in the Middle East? I get asked that all the time. And sometimes, you know, people make you feel like you need a medal for being a woman in the Middle East. I mean, it's nothing could be further from the truth. I think this is a great place to work as a woman because I think attitudes are changing. There is massive awareness around how women are such an important part of the workforce, how they improve business performance, improve decision making, that we must increase the talent pool by including women, particularly as we look away to diversify away from the oil-based economies. Honestly, in Saudi, in the UAE, many times I think it's an advantage being a woman because there is this, particularly at PwC. Maybe I'm just very, very lucky, but PwC is a great firm in terms of its awareness and the initiatives and the proactivity around making sure women have an equal voice and equal opportunity.
But it's interesting. I mean, you work at PwC, large multinational company, which has all the kind of policies in place that you would expect to see. But your clients, because you run the PwC Academy, the training business at PwC, but it's not the in-house training business. Well, there's a bit of that.
Yes.
But you're selling
to
companies and governments around the region. So you're going into the big government departments, the big state-owned organisations of this world, which perhaps haven't traditionally been seen of as quite as progressive, but still no objections to the fact that the person pitching the business is you?
No, absolutely not. No. And in terms of who's in our classrooms, it's always at least 50% women. So the investment in women by government, by these firms, is at least equal to women. And the women are impressive. They're really, really good. And I think employers are recognising that.
And so why then? And this morning, Brandy and I were crunching the numbers on listed companies in the UAE, of which there are 126 at the last count. I cannot think of a single female CEO of one of those companies. I've tried to find a list. I haven't found a list. I'm hoping someone's going to prove me wrong throughout the show this morning. There might be one or two, but it's a very low number, Amanda. Why do you think that is? And what's going to change that? What will be the catalyst?
Yeah, it is a low number and it is too low. I think, you know, we are very good at recruiting graduates these days. There are equal numbers of graduates, particularly at PwC. But by the time you get to the top of the firm and the top of organisations and to boards, there definitely are less women. But it takes time, Richard. So, you know, companies, governments are putting in place policies to help women get to the top. But obviously, it takes time. It's not overnight. So I think it will continue to improve. I think organisations like the 30% Club are doing a great deal to raise awareness, which is fantastic.
Just remind us what that organisation is.
So it came out of the UK and it was formed by some very inspirational women and men in the UK who wanted to see 30% board representation by women in the UK, and they've made huge progress. They now have a chapter in the Middle East, which is also doing great work.
Final question for me on this. Your survey, the PwC research on women in the Middle East, 66% of people said they'd like to see governments putting in place some kind of quotas for women in the workplace. It's always a controversial issue, quotas, isn't it? What do you think are the pros and cons of doing that kind of thing?
Look, I'm firmly on the merit-based side of the argument. Quotas have a role, but generally, I believe women are good enough, well-educated enough, ambitious enough in this region to get there without quotas, as long as their employers genuinely look to give them the equal opportunity they deserve.
Amanda, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Amanda Lyne is a partner with PwC Academy, the talent and skills development business of PwC, on International Women's Day. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Well, we're lightening the mood by talking handbagonomics.
We are indeed talking about investments and where you could be, should be putting your money. Every year, the guys at Knight Frank run a little index looking at a short-term investment, an alternative investment over a year. This woman knows exactly what you should be investing in short term for the best returns.
Hey guys, we are in my purse closet. You might have seen it on my Snapchat or my Instagram. This is pretty much where I keep all my purses. I made a little room for them in my house and I did this all custom so they all could have like a little home and be lit up really pretty. My favorite row definitely would have to be the Hermes row, and I have been collecting these bags for a minute. They're also a great investment.
And she's right, they are a great investment. That is Kylie Jenner. She knows a bit about money, the world's youngest self-made billionaire, according to Forbes. We're not going to argue over the definition of self-made this morning. It's too early. But she is right about the Hermes handbags, or purses, as the Americans call them, being a good investment. Because in the Alternative Investment Asset Index that Knight Frank puts together, what increased the most in value over 12 months was an Hermes bag. Go Kylie Jenner. She's got about 20.
Is this the famous Birkin bag?
It could either be the Birkin or the Kelly, which are very similar,
right?
By the way. Because they look at things like stamps, they look at art, they look at watches, they look at coins, they look at fancy cars, and they look at handbags. The Hermes grew 13%, 1-3, over 12 months, well ahead of the runner-up, which was stamps with 6% growth and art with 5% growth.
I'm looking on the Luxury Closet, which is a Dubai-based purveyor of used secondhand goods. And we've had the founder in several times talking about their various fundraisers, looking at buying one of these things secondhand. Well, the cheapest one I can find at the moment is 42,000 dirhams. There's a crocodile leather one for 149,000 dirhams. This is the Kelly bag that you mentioned. And there's an ombre version of it, Hermes Ombre Himalayan Crocodile Palladium Hardware Kelly Return Bag for 453,000 dirhams, which speaks to Kindy's point and like Frank's point about them being a good investment. What's the deal with these things?
So here's the thing, and it's interesting you mentioned the secondary market, because one of the things that is unusual about the Hermes bag is that it's often more expensive on the secondary market than it is on the initial market. And the reason for that is supply. So the guys at Hermes make sure that they limit the supply, and the supply of each type of handbag that is released each year, there is a massive waiting list. There are people whose whole jobs is to get you on or up the waiting list. By the way, that's literally what they do for a job. Really good nonfiction book I read years and years ago called Bringing Home the Birkin talks you through the sort of the Birkinomics. But it's very, very, very cleverly controlled. And for a rare limited edition bag, you basically need a Birkin broker to get you in there.
You need a what?
A Birkin broker.
That's a
to
thing?
To get you in there. The research firm Bernstein reckons that the new handbags, the Birkins and Kellys that come out each year, only contribute up to 30% of the total Hermes handbags that change hands every year, because so much is done on the secondary market. But because the supply is low, particularly as you said of the different models, it means that things can be more expensive on the secondary market if they're in good condition than on the first. That's the short-term 12-month, however. If you look over the last decade, art actually inches out handbags as an investment. But quite frankly, what would you rather have?
Fred from Karama has been in touch saying, we've got dozens of them for just a few hundred dirhams. Come join us. We're open at 10. No, I made that up. But it reminds me of something from the world of luxury goods that I stupidly aspire to, which is watches. And there's a watch that I really want, which is Patek Philippe, one of the world's leading watchmakers. And there's their watch they make called the Nautilus, which is just a steel watch. It's not a particularly flash watch. One of their more simple watches. I think it's about 80,000 dirhams. But you cannot get on the waiting list for love nor money. It's 8 years if you're lucky enough to be on it. And that watch changes hands, and I'm looking again now. 250,000 dirhams you will pay. So you'll pay 2.5 times the official list price for a watch if you want to have one this week. So if there's scarcity in these luxury goods, then it works. The one difference I would argue is for a watch, it is, I would argue, a durable good because it's made out of metal. A handbag is it's not really a durable good because it's made out of leather.
It's
that would be
durable
the one question
if you look after it. Yeah. If you're carrying it to work every day and it's got your sandwiches inside it, possibly less so.
But maybe they're so well made that they are. But for whatever reason, it's a good investment. My pick of the papers is, I'm afraid, a little bit close at home. It's NMC, the healthcare business. Two updates on that over the past few days. One, they've been kicked out of the FTSE 100 list of the top 100 companies. No surprises, their shares have been delisted, the valuation has plummeted. It was always going to happen, but it has now happened. But there's another one that Arab News is reporting, which is distressing for people here in the UAE. NMC Health hopes it can find a way to pay staff amid its financial crisis. NMC Health, listed in London, but of course a UAE-based hospitals group, has admitted that it has not yet paid thousands of employees for February amid a worsening financial crisis at the company. Now, they've got a new chief executive who came in last week to help try and clean up the mess, quoted by Arab News as saying the past week has been one of the most difficult in recent NMC history. For the first time in several years, NMC was unable to pay your salaries on the 25th of the month. It goes from bad to worse, I'm afraid, for NMC Health. Let's hope for the people who are working there here in the UAE that they do get paid shortly.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Business as usual for a lot of companies here in Dubai. Things continue. And we're going to look now at the acquisition and relaunch of a popular UAE healthy food concept. In October last year, Crush Brands, and they're the people behind Freedom Pizza, bought Salad Jar. Those salads have now been re-released into the wild. Ian Ohan is the founder and CEO of Crush Brands, and he's in the studio with us this morning. Ian, it's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's start at the beginning of this story. How and why did you come to acquire Salad Jar?
So, as some people might know, Danielle Saloum, who's a fellow Canadian, started Salad Jar about 3 or 4 years ago. I think about 4 years ago, did an amazing job, created this great product, which had sort of this crazy cult following. We were approached by them, I guess it was around the summer of last year, and there were some discussions around, possibly them exiting the business, and they really wanted us to have it. So we had over a few months, we had some significant discussions and eventually ended up closing a deal with them in October of last year.
What can you tell us about the financials and the logistics of that deal?
So, I can't disclose the consideration, but it was a decent amount of money. It was a great product and a great business. What we can say is that when we acquired the business, we acquired primarily the IP and certain parts of the operations, but we didn't acquire the central kitchen because our business model was to actually decentralize the central kitchen. And that's why the first thing that we did when we acquired the company was close it. And we've just relaunched it last week.
Has it been relaunched with the same products? What have you changed and what have you kept the same?
Yeah, so we call this phase one. So for Salad Jar customers that don't have everything they had before, you will get it and then some. But we've launched with 10 of the 20 salads. We've launched with one of the two sizes. But we have launched on our own apps and you can now get Salad Jar on demand from most of Dubai. So we've launched with almost the same thing, but we're going to be also adding more menu items and things as we go forward. We launched in Dubai Land, in Dubai Marina, and our downtown stores. And we're launching Barsha this week. We're launching Sharjah next week. We're launching Abu Dhabi later this month. And we'll be doing Dera and Silicon Oasis as well. So you'll be able to get Salad Jar pretty much across the country.
So this isn't the first time you've picked up a local food brand and brought it into your portfolio. There's been Coco Yogo as well, the vegan cheesecake people, as I think of them. There was a Wild Peter at one stage. Why are you so keen to do this? Why are you keen to bring in local brands, to acquire local brands, rather than just launching your own range of salad jars?
Well, so we're doing two things. We're actually developing concepts and acquiring concepts. And our vision is to have sort of 10 highly curated brands under one roof, sort of brands that you love from a company that cares and using our delivery platform and our technology. And so we look at this as if we find an opportunity to purchase a brand that has sort of a following already that's been well established, we'd rather do that because we have other concepts. So we're also launching another home curated concept in about 4 or 5 weeks as well.
And sometimes it works, like the Coco Yogo, which has kind of become a dessert after your pizza for a bit less guilt. And sometimes, as with Wild Peter, it doesn't. What's the difference?
I think it comes down to the situation with Wild Peter was a partnership issue. And so it comes down to people, which it often does in our business. With both Coco Yogo and Salad Jar, it was an outright acquisition. So we were able to basically port that over to our platform and into our ethos and our company ethos.
Are you looking for more?
Yes, we are. Yeah. So we're, as I said, our vision is to have 10 really great, highly curated brands.
But where are the gaps? What kind of things?
Well, you'll see one of them in about four or five weeks, which will be, I'll share it with you. It's sort of a Nashville chicken. Our director of culinary, Chef Justin Snyder, and I have been, he's been cooking and I've been eating. So we've been testing the menu for about 6 or 7 months now.
Well, you mentioned your own delivery platform there, and you are famously not on the aggregators. You do it yourself. What's the demand been like for delivery over the last 3 weeks since the world started changing its habits with the coronavirus outbreak?
So I think our business has been steady to a little bit on the upper side. So I think there's a little uncertainty at the beginning, but now people are home. So there's a lot of delivery. We follow all of our HACCP standards. So we're quite confident in our hygiene and, which requires all of our staff members to use antibacterial soap every 30 minutes. Our drivers wear masks less to protect themselves, more to protect our customers. So we've had a lot of demand from home delivery.
Could you put a percentage on it?
I mean, it would be single digits growth for over similar periods last year. So it's not hugely, larger than last year, but it's certainly larger than last year.
Are you expecting it to get bigger? Are you putting provisions in place, looking at extra drivers? What are the meetings internally like?
Yeah, I think we're status quo, but we are on the plus side in terms of drivers because we have the new brands that we've launched. So we have a heavy lunch delivery trade now with Salad Jar that just launched last week, and as we launch our next concept, we will be adding more drivers as well. So we're sort of adding to demand.
So you're not sitting down in boardrooms thinking, right, if people are self quarantining after holiday, this is this could be a spike for us. You're not putting sort of plan Bs in place and delivering it yourself.
It's pretty easy for us to scale up, so we can scale up very easily on demand with drivers and whatnot. So we're monitoring closely. We're planning around the new launches, meat and Salad Jar last week, and the new brands that we're launching. But with that, we're able to scale up quickly if need be.
Ian O'Hearn, the founder and CEO of Crush Brands, speaking to us about bringing Salad Jar into the Crush family. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.